This podcast is sponsored by The Knowledge Website, a digital digest that cuts through the noise. Brought to you by the founder of The Week, John Connell. Every day, The Knowledge gives you all you need to know in just 5 minutes, delivered straight to your inbox or to your app. Sign up for free at theknowledge.com to get the most interesting ideas, the stories that matter, and the quirkiest anecdotes, all expertly curated.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Spectator Coffeehouse Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Sebastian Coe, President of World Athletics and member of the National Olympic Committee. And we're talking about, you guessed it, the Olympics. In Tokyo, we've had what was often a difficult start in the sense of COVID and how that would affect the games, but Team GB has quickly turned this into a very good news story with medals coming in from lots of different places, some surprising. Seb, you're joining us now. How's it been for you from where you're sitting?
Well, I'm very relieved to be here. Actually, given the year and a half we've all had, I'm just actually relieved to be anywhere at the moment, but particularly in Tokyo. Look, it's been a difficult birth, given that it was only really a year and 2 or 3 months ago that we knew that we weren't actually going in 2020. We were going to have to go in 2021. I take my hat off to the local organising committee because I can only imagine having chaired the London organising committee if somebody knocked on my door in the headquarters in March or April of 2012 and said, oh, by the way, your opening ceremony is not going on July the 27th that year. We're going 1 year down the road. The complexity and the challenge has been enormous. And, you know, throw on to the top of that the fact that we've had to get the athletes here safely and securely and also be, you know, recognise that there are local fragilities about the thought of us all being here in the first place. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to go off. It's going to go off well. I think we're going to see some outstanding performances. And yet again, if I'm being parochial for a moment, wearing not an international hat, but Team GB is again pulling the nation together, isn't it?
James, are you sensing much of a boost in public morale over here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Olympics always excites people. And I think that the timings are difficult here in terms of, you know, that when the main events are taking place. But obviously, Team GB winning a series of medals, you know, it does put a smile on people's faces. People get interested in sports that they wouldn't be interested in for 3 years and 11 months. But then, you know, there is that Olympic buzz to it. I mean, I think one of the kind of interesting political questions, I suppose, about this is how efficient the Olympic funding model seems to be. You know, there seems to be such a direct correlation between the money that is put into backing the athletes and the number of medals that Team GB wins. And I was just sort of thinking about this, which is, I just do sometimes wonder whether it's just sport or are there broader lessons to be learned about, you know, how to channel resources in the public sector from this?
I think the broader lesson for me has always been that, first of all, you don't get excellence on the cheap. And James is right. I became deputy chair of the old UK Sports Council far too long ago. And I always remember being taken aside by one of our then world-class weightlifting coaches. His name was John Lear, and he grabbed me literally on the first day in the office and he said, you won't go wrong if you adopt Lear's law. And I sort of looked a little blankly at him and he smiled and said, well, aren't you going to ask me what Lear's law is? And I said, yes, OK, tell me what Lear's law. And he said, well, it's very simple. He said the weight a man can lift above his head is in direct proportion to the size of the Sports Council grant. And he said, if you remember that, you won't go wrong. And actually, in a sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek anecdote, it's actually absolutely the case. And the funding that went, well, first of all, we have a massive debt of gratitude to the National Lottery. National Lottery really did change that landscape. We probably wouldn't have been able to deliver a Games without the Olympic Games in 2012 without a National Lottery. And what it has done is it's given consistency to member federations to employ coaches, not for 18 months on short-term contracts, but to have them there over a decade, identifying talent, nurturing that talent, and then bringing it to fruition. And if there is a political lesson here, it is that, first of all, I genuinely believe the litmus test of any country is how you deal with and how you exalt excellence. And in terms of, for instance, the British Olympic Association in the last few years and UK sport and the way that sport has operated, you know, there are very, very few countries that can get within a country mile of the processes that we've now put in place. I do hope that government will continue over the next funding cycle to support Team GB in the way it's done in the past, because I genuinely think that the inspiration that those medalists in their own local neighbourhoods can bring to young people, giving them purpose and maybe an anchor in their lives, it's an investment that goes way, way beyond a medals table.
And James, listening to that, can you see any lessons the government can learn when it comes to how they organise things?
I mean, I think there's always the problem with government strategies in the UK is that they tend to end up propping up losers rather than picking winners. I think the fascinating thing about the success of Team GB is how successful it seems to be at picking winners, at working out what sports the UK is most likely to gain medals in, and then putting money and resource into that. And I think that is an interesting question about, you know, working out what your strengths are on the global stage and then backing them. I mean, there probably are some lessons to be learned in that. And also, I think there's another thing here, which is there does seem to be a ruthlessness about the funding, which is if you don't get results, the funding seems to disappear quite fast. So, I mean, there probably are lessons on that front from the Games, but one should always be cautious at extrapolating too much from sport to the rest of life, I think.
I think that, for me, the lesson here is the consistency of planning and, you know, securing, agreeing a strategy and actually delivering on it, and delivering on it over, you know, a sensible and sequential period of time. What I hope we don't do, and, you know, I'm beginning to pick up odd murmurings around this, is this policy, James, actually, you're right. I mean, it was actually called the no-compromise approach. And the no-compromise approach was really simple. It was identify the talent. If they were likely to win medals, you invested in them. If that talent at any stage in that four-year, maybe even eight-year pathway looked like they weren't going to achieve that, then actually, yeah, they were cut from the program. So it has been quite ruthless. But if you think that in 1996 we came out of the Atlanta Games with virtually no medals at all, we didn't get a single gold in track and field, and there was only a handful of medals in any other sports, and you sort of roll it forward to 2012 and then in Rio in 2016, when we finished second on the medals table, the transformation by adopting that policy has really been quite extraordinary.
And Seb, just briefly, I want to move on to looking ahead to the next big Olympics, though we're obviously still in the middle of this one. But when we're talking about, I suppose, ruthlessness and obviously everyone being at their best, I just couldn't help think, and I wonder what you thought about this. There does seem to be a growing sense at this Olympic Games, if you look at Simone Biles and other candidates, where lots of people talking about how there's too much of a focus on gold and there's more to an athlete than just winning. Do you think there is a change in approach or mood around this, or am I overreading from some of those comments?
No, I don't think you're overreading it at all. But look, I think you can't divorce sport from the everyday, nor should you. I mean, we're not hermetically sealed. And, you know, if you look at the discourse that's taken place, certainly in the last 5 years around mental health, it doesn't really surprise me that sport wouldn't want to be A, part of that discussion, and B, very high profile when you do have competitors like Simone Biles, who clearly have struggled on the greatest platform. I think the difference this time is that if you throw on top of that the attendant challenges there always will be for some people in a very pressurized environment, and there are none more pressurized than the Olympic Games. I mean, you know, sitting in a call-up room 40 minutes before a major race, looking at eight other people in a room barely the size of a cupboard and looking at each and every one of you, wondering who's got the national lottery ticket in their pocket, that is an Arctic loneliness moment. And, you know, you look to federations, you look to good coaches. Good coaches, by implication, are actually pretty good psychologists. You know, you hope that you've got the right structure around these competitors. But the difference this time is that the very fact they've got here has meant that they've been through a year and a half of not just physical challenge, but mental turmoil as well. Some of them have been locked at home, you know, in houses where they've not, if they're endurance athletes, they've barely been able to train. Some have had the specificity of their training, you know, carried out on balconies of apartments. You know, it's been a really, really tough journey. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, that some of these, you know, some of these mental health issues have surfaced in a higher and probably a more livid way at these games than they would have done had we not been through a year and a half of, you know, of curtailed freedoms.
And finally, we're clearly on this Olympics, but the Winter Olympics is 2022 and it's in Beijing. James, in terms of the political stories around the Olympics, we're already hearing Dominic Raab questions about whether the foreign secretary will attend, or perhaps further questions about wider attendance. What are you picking up and what's the challenge for the government here?
So I think the most likely outcome when it comes to Winter Olympics is a similar approach to when Russia hosted the World Cup, which is the team goes, but you don't have the royal family or politicians go to the games. I mean, that is probably the most likely compromise. I do, though, wonder if you think that if you look at this, you know, as Joe Biden puts it, you're in a new competition between democracy and autocracy. I think if you look at the geopolitical tensions between the US and China, it's hard to see that they don't only grow in the coming decades. And I wonder whether we're heading back to actually the kind of dynamics you had in the 80s when the US boycotted the Moscow Olympics in 1980, when the USSR responded by boycotting the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984. I wonder whether the ability to separate sport from politics is going to be challenged by the fact that we are once more kind of entering an era of kind of great power ideological competition.
And Sev, what are your reflections on that? Because obviously, if you look at the medals you won and your entry into the Olympics, it was during that period where there were, you know, boycotts of countries not participating at points.
Well, I don't think I'm going to say anything too revelatory or particularly revolutionary when I say that I dislike boycotts. I mean, they're intellectually incoherent and historically illiterate. I mean, the very fact that we are still, you know, talking about troops in one shape or another leaving Afghanistan 40 years after, you know, the attempted boycott from Jimmy Carter, probably one of the worst presidents in the history of the United States, that did nothing but actually damage the ambitions of athletes, doesn't really muster the irony it should have done. So, look, I don't think you go to any country with your eyes closed. The very nature of making a judgment about where you're going to take a sport does inevitably have to be set, you know, in a particular background. But look, I don't actually believe it's a sensible approach for us to sort of decide it's a bit of an a la carte menu. If we've got an Olympic Games, we should have ministers there. We should have people going to that country, because I'm a great believer that no major sporting event has actually ever left a country without in one way or another flicking the social, political and cultural dial. And you have to be very careful. I mean, I remember being the chair of the London Organising Committee in 2012. You know, we had a full house of countries and diplomatic and political representation there. But, you know, I'm also well aware that there are many countries that came to London who probably were holding their nose over, you know, some of our own foreign policies. So you've got to be very careful when you pick your sporting relationships predicated on, you know, here today and gone tomorrow, political structures and leaders. Sport is too important to be used in that way. And actually, if it's used well, it can be a pretty effective soft power.
Thank you, Seb. Thank you, James.